Hello there, I'm Nastasia Tay, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, oil and gas majors are raking in their earnings on the backs of the poorest people, says the United Nations. It's urging a windfall tax on their profits to support households and the most vulnerable. Will governments heed the call? Also this week, the race is on for semiconductors, and the US is spending billions of dollars to boost domestic manufacturing while keeping an eye on China. Can America rival Asia's market? Plus, the sales of video game giants have dropped in the second quarter of this year. Are gamers spending less time playing? And is it game over for the pandemic boom? Now, a new study found the oil and gas industry has produced almost $3 billion a day in profits for the last 50 years. It's now cashing in even more money as the war in Ukraine has driven up energy prices. The UN Secretary General has criticized these sky-high earnings as grotesque greed at a time when millions of people around the world are feeling the pinch of the rising cost of living. Antonio Guterres has urged governments to tax the profits of fossil fuel giants to help those in need.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate. The combined profits of the largest energy companies in the first quarter of this year are close to $100 billion. I urge all governments to tax these excessive profits and use the funds to support the most vulnerable people through these difficult times.
Well, Guterres's call comes as energy giants have recorded eye-watering figures for the second quarter of the year. BP reported a profit of almost $9 billion. That's its biggest windfall in 14 years. American energy giant ExxonMobil pocketed around $18 billion. The net income is the company's largest ever quarterly profit. Europe's largest oil company, Shell, has broken the record for a second quarter in a row with profit of more than $11 billion. Those three major companies put together with the US firm Chevron and France's TotalEnergies made $55 billion this past quarter. And it's not just oil and gas. Glencore, the world's largest coal shipper, also made record profits and plans to pay an additional $4.5 billion in dividends and buybacks to shareholders. Now, while companies are reaping the benefits, households are struggling to pay high energy bills. Food prices have also surged. They've risen around 50% since 2019. The UN says more than 50 million people across 45 countries are now on the brink of famine. Well, joining us now from London is Adi Amshirovich. He's a senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies and also author of the book Trading and Price Discovery for Crude Oils. Thanks so much for joining us on Counting the Cost. Adi, I'll start by asking you what you make of Guterres's suggestion, because I know many economists would argue that taxing profits at a time of short supply could backfire.
In the long term, it would definitely backfire. I think taxing profits is a terrible idea on a number of levels. The first reason why it's a bad idea is that it basically penalizes the companies that are actually supposed to be investing into energy exactly at the time when we need it most. Secondly, also, it sort of picks and chooses winners. Why are we taxing energy companies? A lot of other companies had windfall profits as well. Why not tax Google and Facebook? Why not tax law firms? There are a lot of companies that from time to time have windfall profits for whatever reasons, and those profits are usually an incentive for them to actually invest into the resources that are badly needed. So if we tax them, we're not going to get those resources in the long run.
Well, we have a number of case studies here. The UK and India, for instance, have imposed these windfall taxes. What do you make of their success?
You know, it's too early to say. We've only just had them. In fact, from the energy industry point of view, probably that it won't have a terribly big negative effect. It will have a negative effect, but not particularly big, because it happened at the time where we have Russian invasion on Ukraine, mm-hmm. and a lot of energy companies basically managed to make quite a bit of money out of their resources that they have in the North Sea or elsewhere in terms of oil and gas production. But we're really not passing the right message, Anastasia. I'll give you an example. Let's say Centrica is producing a lot of gas in the UK, having a windfall tax is just going to send a message to everyone, well, if you invest more into the UK and UK gas production, which we need really, really badly, mm-hmm. well, and you make money, we are going to tax you. The same thing applies to EDF, for example. EDF is making a lot of money out of their nuclear power plants because, as we know, electricity prices are quite high. Well, they're producing clean electricity, green electricity, nuclear electricity. And why should they be taxed? I mean, basically, the message is, well, don't invest into these green resources because we are going to tax you as soon as you make some money.
Well, I noticed that the US has so far avoided a tax like this, but I believe the White House hasn't actually ruled it out. Now, given that Biden has had such stern words for oil companies and refiners, what do you make of the state of play there now?
Well, the United States obviously is a lot more market oriented. And I think also in the mind of the consumers, it's a lot easier to do these taxes in Europe and the UK, where we are used to having a nanny state. Hmm. In the United States, it's a lot less so. So, you know, I think it's very important to go to the consumer and actually explain that gas prices are international prices, oil prices are international prices, gas prices went up tenfold. So when something goes up tenfold, well, surely it's going to go up at home as well. Just like the price of coffee, you know, there's not much UK government can do about the prices. What the UK government and all the governments can do and should be doing is helping those who really are hit badly, who are in need, and they should be given cash, not subsidies. Because what happens, Stasia, is that, for example, when you subsidize gas prices, as they are right now in the UK, and there's a lot of talk about price freezes, terrible, terrible idea. I'll come back to that in a second. What happens, you're actually subsidizing the rich more than anyone else. Mm. People in big mansions, people driving big cars and so on.
So you're suggesting public cash transfers then to the most vulnerable?
Absolutely. Give those in need cash. Giving, subsidizing or freezing even, because there were some calls in some quarters, Lib Dem party suggested freezes. Terrible idea. 1970s, lessons from 1970s we haven't learned. Nixon administration imposed price freezes. And what happened? There were shortages of energy. What happens is that if the energy companies have to pay this price, and you give them that price, they'll say, well, we are not going to invest anymore. We are not going to do this because we're losing money. You have a really good case in France. EDF's now being nationalized. Why? Because the government basically imposed very harsh price caps on energy. And companies, in Germany is the other one, Uniper, where basically went bankrupt. Then when the governments think they have a free lunch, then eventually, in the long run, what they end up doing is actually, you know, nationalizing these companies and spending billions and billions of dollars.
Well, Adi, you suggested that taxes like the windfall tax we've been talking about discourage investment. So then is all of this then really just part of the pain that we need to go through in order to get to a green transition?
Absolutely. Well, you know, all of those who are calling for energy subsidies, for example, gas, just have to remember, look at outside. I mean, we have climate change happening now. It's not happening in future. And you want to subsidize fossil fuels? Is that what we want to do? No, God, no, we shouldn't be doing that. What we do need to do is help. And there is a growing fraction of the population that need help. That help should be given in terms of cash to those in need. Everyone else should pay the full price of the fossil fuels. And that would also be an incentive to move much quicker to onshore wind, for example, offshore wind and other green sources of energy that we need really, really badly, and we need them now, rather than give money to Putin.
Very interesting. Adi Mshirovich, the Senior Research Fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us on Counting the Cost.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now, Thailand, like many countries, is facing sharp increases in the costs of food and fuel. Its central bank is following in the steps of many others, hiking rates to try to tame inflation. But in a society where the gap between rich and poor is one of the worst in the world, Thai say the government's efforts will bring little relief. Tony Cheng reports.
Nestled between embassies and gleaming high-rises in the centre of Bangkok, a community on the other side of the wealth gap. In the shadow of a new apartment complex, Wanisa lives with her three children. She says her income barely covers the family's costs or repayments of loans she's been forced to take.
I want to have a better life, but I can't. I just have to accept my fate because I was born in this condition and I have to take what is available. I just spend my life day to day trying to get enough to eat and live, that's all.
During the pandemic, many people lost jobs and incomes dropped. And now the cost of living is rising sharply. They're not getting any help.
We barely get any help from the government. We don't get anything. We only get help from foundations and charities when we reach out to them.
Thailand's often cited as a success story when it comes to reducing poverty, but the wealth here has not been evenly distributed. And in the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Report of 2018, Thailand was listed as one of the most unequal places in the world.
In the years since then, life has been even harder for lower-income communities. By the side of a busy expressway, some of the most vulnerable are struggling to survive. This is a community for the deaf and hard of hearing, often cast out by their families. Fon takes us under the bridge where she, her husband and several other families have made homes from refuse and scrap. She explains their disability allowance of $20 a month barely lasts a few days. The strain is enormous. They try to salvage what they can from the waste others throw away. And with the roar of the traffic overhead, life goes on, while their complaints go unanswered. Tony Cheng, Al Jazeera, Bangkok.
Well, while fossil fuels power the globe, semiconductors drive the digital economy. The tiny computer chips are seen as the oil of the 21st century. They run everything from smartphones to missile defense systems. After a global shortage hit hard, many countries are racing to secure uninterrupted supplies. Now, among them is the United States, which has just approved a multi-billion dollar bill to boost domestic production. The bipartisan bill includes more than $52 billion in subsidies for U.S. companies producing computer chips, as well as billions more in tax credits to encourage investment and research in the industry. The U.S. falls behind Asia in chip manufacturing with a global share of at least 10%, compared to almost 40% just a few decades ago. But it does lead in cutting-edge chip design. Well, let's hear what President Joe Biden had to say when he signed that bill into law.
It's crystal clear. We need these semiconductors not only for those Javelin missiles, but also for weapon systems of the future that are going to be even more reliant on advanced chips. Unfortunately, we produce 0% of these advanced chips now. And China is trying to move away ahead of us in manufacturing these sophisticated chips as well. It's no wonder the Chinese Communist Party actively lobbied U.S. business against this bill. The United States must lead the world in the production of these advanced chips. This law will do exactly that.
Well, China has criticized that bill as a threat to trade and an attack on Chinese businesses. The nation imports more than $300 billion worth of semiconductors annually, but aims to produce 70% of its own chips by 2025. Around 90% of the world's most advanced chips, though, are made in Taiwan. The rest come from South Korea. European legislators also plan multi-billion dollar investments in the industry over the coming years. Well, joining us now from Singapore is Alex Capri. He's a research fellow at the Heinrich Foundation and also a lecturer at the National University of Singapore Business School. Alex, are we seeing the emergence of a new semiconductor cold war here?
What we're seeing is a reshuffling, a restructuring, a paradigm shift, if you will, around global value chains and global supply chains when it comes to strategic goods. And at the top of that list are semiconductors.
How much, then, do you think this bill will actually help the U.S. in particular try to regain its leading role in semiconductor production?
It's important to step back and take a look at the state of the semiconductor industry as a whole. So U.S. companies still dominate the technology. They still dominate the IP, the manufacturing equipment, the tooling. But what has happened over the last 30 years is U.S. Chip makers have offshored manufacturing. So we have these pure play type scenarios where a company like TSMC in Taiwan, as a contract manufacturer, is manufacturing on behalf of, it's making the chips for big companies like Qualcomm, for example. And so what the U.S. wants to do now, given this strategic rivalry with China, given the sensitivity of global supply chains because of the pandemic and so forth, is it wants to bring that manufacturing back to the United States. And that's what the CHIPS Act is all about.
I see that the companies that would benefit from this bill, they're then actually not allowed to increase their production, particularly of advanced chips in China. Just how attractive is that for the big hitters?
Well, this has been the game that the semiconductor companies have been playing in China, a so-called in China for China strategy. And that is continue to sell mature, older generation technology in China, in the Chinese market, make a lot of money, use that money and plow that back into innovation and research, but don't sell, because of export controls and sanctions, for example, don't sell leading edge technology to the Chinese. Mm. Now, what's going to probably happen in the coming months and years is the U.S. is going to crack down and choke off even that older, mature technology that's going into China and that is fueling China's growth in the trailing edge section of semiconductors. And that means that we're going to see further bifurcation in the markets. We're going to see further decoupling, if you will. And it's going to be more difficult for China to try and become self-sufficient when it comes to semiconductors.
Well, you've been talking about this strategic rivalry. And as you alluded to, the industry leader we're talking about here is Taiwanese. Do you think that the tensions we've seen escalate recently over Taiwan, could that affect the supply chain?
Putting too much dependence on one country, and this is Taiwan, this is for manufacturing. Again, we have to be very clear. We're talking about manufacturing of chips in particular. So clearly, the move, not just in the United States, but in Europe, in Japan, in South Korea, is all about diversifying and avoiding a single source supply chain situation with a single point of failure, for example, which would be Taiwan. So we're going to see reshoring all over the world. And it's also going to involve Taiwanese companies. So TSMC is investing in the United States. It's investing in Europe. We could see India emerging to a certain extent as a place where the big Taiwanese companies and others will invest.
Well, let me ask you then about the rare earths shortage that we've seen around the world. Now, given that China's been very focused on the supply of those materials that you need to produce semiconductors, what does that mean for other countries like the US or India?
Well, it's part of the decoupling process that we're seeing. And we have the United States, Australia, Canada, for example, reopening, for example, the Mountain Pass mine in California, which used to be the world's largest extractor and processor of rare earths before that was all offshore to China. So in this decoupling process from China, in this reshoring ring fencing process that we're seeing, we're going to see friendshoring. In other words, we're going to see strategic partners such as the United States, UK, Japan, Australia, working together to reopen and to reshore these supply chains. And that's exactly what's happening with rare earths as well.
So do you then see broader political implications for the future of semiconductors here, a bifurcated world then?
Absolutely. So, a semiconductor is not just a hyper-strategic good for weaponry and for sophisticated electronics. It is a public good. It is every bit as important to a nation as energy, water, or food security. So we are going to see increased emphasis on self-reliance, or at least on strategic alliances around supply chains involving semiconductors.
Alex Capri there from the Heinrich Foundation speaking to us from Singapore. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your thoughts with us. Well, gaming has outgrown the earnings of some of the biggest entertainment companies in the past decade, becoming even bigger than movies and the music industry combined. Pandemic lockdowns and stay-home restrictions saw a growth in users as more people reached for their consoles. Last year, the industry racked up almost $180 billion in revenue. But with holiday travel taking off again, the gaming industry has taken a hit. Video game giants have seen millions of dollars of losses in revenue in recent weeks. In the 3 months that ended in June, Microsoft, Sony and Nintendo each reported a fall in sales. Americans spent more than $12 billion on games in the second quarter, according to market research firm NPD. That's down 13% year on year. China's video game revenues in the first half of 2022 fell for the first time since data became available in 2008. Well, joining us now from London is Willy Ledon-Werther. He's a professor of economic sociology and digital social research at the Oxford Internet Institute. That's part of the University of Oxford. So, Willy, what's gone wrong for video game companies? I imagine the semiconductor shortage we've just been talking about hasn't helped either.
That's right. So one problem has been the supply chain crisis. So console manufacturers are not getting all their products in front of consumers. But also the war, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has led some game publishers to pull out from Russia. And this has obviously had a negative impact on their revenues. And then a further reason is that Apple has, since last year, started limiting the data it gives out to app developers on players. And this has led to basically a decrease in revenues from ad-supported games, as well as an increase in acquisition costs for game publishers, because advertising is now less targeted. And it's also further sort of entrenched the centrality of Apple's own app store as a gateway between app developers and consumers. And all of these things are eating a little bit into the game industry's revenues.
How much of a difference has the pandemic made? Because intuitively, you kind of think everyone's stuck at home. Surely some of them are playing video games.
Yes. So actually, during 2020 and 2021, the games industry grew a lot. So there was something like a 25% spurt in the size of the market. This is massive growth. And so if there's a little bit of a correction now, that's almost to be expected as people are going out again and maybe playing some of those games that they bought during the lockdown.
Do you think then we could potentially see an uptick in the industry when people have gotten bored of going out and want to be back at home?
Yes, certainly the industry overall looks very healthy. So I don't think game playing or the games industry is going anywhere. And certainly I would expect them to find new sources of growth in due course.
Well, speaking of sources of growth, I see Chinese gamers in particular are hitting the pause button. Why is that?
Obviously, one thing in China is that the government last year started massive crackdowns on the games industry. So limiting the amount of time that minors are permitted to spend on games, as well as suspending new licenses for games publishers. So publishers in China need a license to publish any game, and the regulator has suspended and still to some extent is suspending new licenses. And this has had a big impact on Chinese publishers' ability to introduce new titles to the market. And this is obviously having an impact on their revenues as well. So that would be certainly one reason.
Well, let me ask you then broadly about the future of the industry. I see companies like Netflix, for instance, are also now investing in video games. Where do you see all of this going?
Well, for Netflix, the way their executives speak about it, it sounds like it's still a bit of an experiment. They're trying to figure out what to do with games. But if you look at what TV shows they have, some of their shows were actually based on games already before Netflix started then turning some shows into games. And so turning media franchises into these multimedia franchises is, of course, a very old strategy in the media business, and these different media can support each other. So certainly I would expect to continue to see that, where games are not just games, but they're also films, they're also animations, they're also merchandise. Another thing, since we're talking about the future, I think also in the games industry, as well as everywhere in the tech industry, the power and centrality of these tech giants like Apple and Google and Microsoft, I think it's going to continue to be an increasing trend.
and even more investment despite the industry downturn at the moment. Vili Lerdonwerter there from the Oxford Internet Institute, thanks for joining us on Counting the Cost.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's our show for this week. Do get in touch with us by tweeting me at Nastasia Tay, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's also more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, entire episodes for you to catch up on. Well, that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nastasia Tay, and from the whole team here, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.